Hi, my name's Michael Earle, and I'm a female alcoholic. And it's a privilege to be here, and I feel very humbled to be with this lineup of speakers. They have just blown me away. They really have, and I just feel very honored. And also, it's such a thrill to get to be a speaker I haven't heard before. A lot of the times you speak with the same speakers, and you can almost get up there and tell each other stories. So it's nice to hear stories that I haven't heard before. But it's still the language of the heart, you know, where the heart speaks and the heart listens. I had an opportunity. It's one of the greatest opportunities I've had speaking is I was invited to speak in Iceland, and I got to do that in August. And it was their very first AA convention. And it was such a gift. The whole conference was in Icelandic. And I couldn't understand a word anybody said. We couldn't read anything. We had not a clue about anything. But, you know, there's this little 10-minute speaker that got up and talked before I talked. And I couldn't understand a word she said, but I watched the group, and I watched how they responded, and when they laughed, when they cried, and when they... You know, and I mean, it was really, really, I got to know what they mean when they talk about the language of the heart, you know, where the heart speaks and the heart listens, and that's what I got to experience in Iceland, and I'm so appreciative to have gotten that experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get to speak a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just feel very blessed that I get to do this a lot. I do not consider this my form of service, however. I've never read anywhere in the big book about being a speaker. It's just absolutely not my form of service. I feel like this is a gift God has given me to walk through my fears because I was terrified of standing up in front of people. I never shared my story till I was 11 years sober. At 4 years of sobriety, I could not stand up here and read how it works. I just couldn't do it. I was so terrified. And I couldn't get on an airplane till I was 12 and a half years sober. So speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to walk through my fears. And it's one of the greatest gifts when you're finally willing to walk through those fears. You know, the things that happen, you know, getting a chance to go to Iceland, meeting my husband. You know, I was speaking in South Carolina. I lived in California, and that's where I met my husband, and that's what brings me to Georgia. And aside from my sobriety, my husband is the greatest gift that I've received in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so very thankful. I'm thankful for the willingness that I had to walk through that fear. I'm always nervous. I don't know why, I just am. It's just part of who I am. But anyway, as I said, speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous is not my form of service. My form of service is being in the trenches with drunks. And we're talking about wet drunks. We detox people in our home, and Ted and I are in the perfect position to do that. We don't have children in our house. We have a nice four-bedroom home, and so we always have newcomers living with us. We've been married for almost 6.5 years. And in 6.5 years, only 4 months have we not had someone living with us. We've had anywhere from 1 to 6 newcomers living with us. And when you have 6 newcomers in the house, it's really active. It's active and it's exciting, and Ted and I can't keep up. So we're trying really hard to keep it down to 2 or 3. And but it's a gift, you know, it's a gift. And Ted and I make the perfect match when it comes to working with others. My gift, I think the gift that, you know, they say everybody has a niche in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my niche is taking people through the steps. That is my niche. And Ted's niche is teaching them how to live. You know, he gets these people that come, you know, they come into our home. I get them through the steps, and he teaches them how to live. And we get people in our home that don't have driver's license. They've lost their license. They don't have automobiles. They don't have a place to live. They don't have high school diplomas. They don't have checking accounts. They haven't a clue how to go out there and live. And they stay with us long enough to learn those things. And Ted's the one that teaches those kinds of things to them. So we just make the perfect pair to do this. And we have a lot of success. I mean, God has a lot of success through us. I would say, well, I wouldn't, maybe half and half, half stay sober, which is a big success, right? Yeah. You know, it's kind of like what it says in the big book, in the second foreword. It says, out of the people that come in here and really try, and I mean, we're talking about really try, 50% get sober right away and never relapse. And I believe this is true today also. And then 25% relapse, they go back out and they come back in. And the other 25%, their life improves. And we have a lot of people that have gone back out that I can say that they still keep coming back and that their life has improved. You know, and so we really get to see things happening today that are in the big book, especially in the chapter Working with Others. And that's a very important chapter for us because it talks about using discretion when you're taking people into your home. And we have learned that we can enable some of the people that we take into our home. We've had we've had some bad experiences with enabling, and so we've gone to Al-Anon. No. We've learned some valuable lessons, and so we use discretion with people that we take in our home. We just don't take, people know that we take them in our home. People are in our home, so they'll call us and just say, oh, there's Joe Blow, and he's drunk and needs a place to stay. We don't take, you know, that's our home. That's our home. So we watch people for a while. We watch them in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If they just keep suiting up and showing up, and they look like they're trying, and they're reaching out for sponsorship, and we just watch them for a while before we take them into our home, because that is our home. And we try to use discretion, and we try to follow what it says in Chapter 7 in the Big Book. However, we do detox anybody in our house. And the sad thing is that we are losing our detox. We're losing our treatment centers. You know, alcoholics are so therapeutic slick that insurance companies are getting tired of paying for treatment. They're getting tired of paying for detoxes, and we're losing our treatment centers. And so all of us eventually are going to be forced to have to take people into our homes to at least detox them. And Ted and I have had a lot of experience detoxing people, and it's pretty serious. You know, we really do need detoxes. We need treatment centers because some of these people really need to be detoxed medically. And we've had some close calls. We've had some really close calls, but I wouldn't trade these experiences for anything. And another thing that we do is we work with the treatment center at Fort Gordon. We have a military base. Fort Gordon, it's in the Augusta area, and it's one of the last treatment centers, one of the very last treatment centers for the military. The military is getting sick of paying for treatment too, and so they're phasing out all their treatment centers, and there's only about three of them left, and one of them is at Fort Gordon. So they get guys in all arms of the services, anywhere from a private to a colonel. We get that, you know, they're all there in that treatment center. And they're there for 28 days, and Ted goes there on Wednesdays, and he does a newcomer meeting. And then we have gotten permission from Fort Gordon to take these guys from the treatment center every Wednesday night to our house. And we have a barbecue. We want to show them that we're not a glum lot, that we can have fun and sobriety. We have a lot of people from our home group that come, and we have a good time. And then we go into what I call my AA room, and we get into the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what the very first thing I do with these guys from the military is I tell them the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, much like I did yesterday, because a lot of them have trouble with God, and I really feel like if you hear and understand the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's hard to deny that there's a God, and it's a loving God, and that God loves drunks so much that he gave us the 12 steps to recover. And then we get into step one out of the Big Book, step two. Step three, we get them on their knees praying and saying the third step prayer and started on their fourth step by the time they leave. And hopefully when they go back to whatever state they came from, they'll get a sponsor and continue. That is our hope. And anyway, so I'm going to tell you an experience that we had with one of these soldiers. First of all, I want to tell you, this last six years has been one of the hardest periods of my sobriety. You know, when you get older in sobriety, you also get chronologically older. You know, my body's getting older. And all I can say is getting old is not for sissies. I mean, I wish I could identify with our speaker last night. I can't. She looks fabulous, and she looks like she has no physical problems whatsoever. I am just in awe. But that's not my experience. I have just been falling apart. And in the last 5 years, I've had 9 surgeries. And that is very embarrassing for me. I have a lot of shame about that. You know, I have a lot of shame. I have shame because I used to judge my mom. My mom used to have a lot of surgeries. She was always sick. I knew she was a hypochondriac. And I knew she just wanted to take pain pills and she just wanted to drink, that those things were not real. And I've come to know those things are real, because some of the things my mom suffered, I'm now suffering. And I have found, whether it's in the program, out of the program, in childhood, whatever, when I judge somebody, when I'm judging somebody, I end up walking in their shoes, experiencing their experience to get over the judgment. And that's a heavy price to pay. And that's what I've had to experience with this health issue. And you know, sometimes I have my fist up at God, and I just say, you know, don't you see how much I do in Alcoholics Anonymous? How can you let this happen to me? I don't know why it's happening, but I've had to go through it. But I know one of my favorite sentences in the Big Book is the bottom of 14, top of 15. It says, "For if an alcoholic fails to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive those certain trials and low spots ahead." And that basically tells us two things. First of all, it tells us if we're not working with others, we fail to grow spiritually. We can pray, we can meditate, we can go to church. But if we're not working with others, we fail to grow spiritually. And then it also tells me if I'm not working with others, I'm not going to survive those trials and low spots ahead. And we're guaranteed trials and low spots. You know, life still happens on life's terms. People still get sick. People still get old. People still die. Accidents still happen. Tragedies still happen. And what gets me through these things is working with others. And the book, you know, tells us that that's what's going to get us all through these situations, is working with others. If we can get out of ourselves long enough to think about somebody else, God can get in there and fix whatever it is that needs fixing for our individual situation. But anyway, so this was one of these days. I had a surgery on Tuesday, and I woke up Wednesday morning, and I had stitches, and I was running a fever, and I did not feel good. You know, they send you home right away now. And I just woke up that morning, and I just told my husband, I said, I just cannot meet with these soldiers tonight. I just can't do it. I just don't feel like it. I'm in too much pain. But I always suit up and I show up. You know, that's what I was taught to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can feel pain laying in bed just like I can feel pain sitting on a couch talking to those newcomers. So what's the difference? So I just showed up that night, and we were on step two. And this one soldier, first of all, we had about 35 guys in this room, and we have to move everything to get all these people in the room. And we have outside AAs, too. In fact, a lot of people that start sponsoring, they send their newcomers to our house to do the first three steps with these soldiers. So it's gotten to be a really big deal. But anyway, so we had this one soldier, and he was sitting in this chair right here, and he just kind of jumped up, and he got in my face, and he said, "If there's a God, it's going to take a burning bush to prove it to me." And first of all, I was very intimidated. I'm sitting down, and he's standing over me, you know, yelling at me, and all these people are looking at me like I ought to have these words of wisdom to say to him. And I'm thinking, oh, God, I'm out of burning bushes. So anyway, I said, what's your name again? And he said his name was Lee. So that inspired me to tell him a story about another man named Lee that sent me a letter about a spiritual experience he had during one of my talks. And honest to goodness, I am not taking any credit for any of this stuff. This has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with somebody and being ready to have a spiritual experience. It's between that person and God. I just happened to be the speaker at the meeting that he attended. You know, he was at the jumping off place. He had some sobriety, but he didn't have a God that he trusted. And so he was trying to make the decision of whether to commit suicide or to drink again. And he just wandered into my meeting. And anyway, he wrote in this letter. It took him 2 years to write me this letter because he doubted his spiritual experience. But he wrote in this letter that the whole time I was talking, he's looking down at the floor just thinking about himself and his little old problems and what he's going to do, suicide or drink again. And finally, I always close my story with how I came to terms with the God I have in my life. And how that happened was through a tragedy. I mean, my daughter was 18 years old. She was kidnapped from an AA dance, brutally raped, and almost murdered. And it took me many years and several spiritual experiences to come to terms with my God because of this. And what I came to know, and I'll close my story with it, how I came to know this, but what I came to know is that God is good and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God. That there is a difference between man's world and God's world. And everything in God's world is perfect, but in man's world it's not. So anyway, I was sharing that. I was closing my story, and I was saying the words, God is good, good is God. So he wrote, as I started to say those words, God is good, good is God, it started echoing out of his ears, and this force started to pull his chin up. And no matter what he did, he couldn't keep his chin down. Now, on the stage, this is in Alabama. It's called Gulf Shores Jubilee, and there's a neon light that's in Mardi Gras colors that says Jubilee. And he's writing all this in this letter. So this force starts to pull his chin up, and by the time his head comes up, and I'm saying, God is good, good is God, his eyes looked up at me, the speaker, and my body is blocking the whole part of the sign that says Juba, and the only part he could see was the word Lee, L-E-E, that was his name. So it was like, God is good, good is God. He looks up, and there's his name in neon lights, and it's like, he's talking to you. And so, and his life changed from that point on. His life changed, but it took him 2 years to write me that letter. So I'm sharing that story with this soldier named Lee, who's sitting right here. And this is the honest to God truth. I'm saying the words, God is good, good is God. We moved everything over. There's a bush back there. That bush, almost identical to that bush, was right here on the couch next to me. And because we shoved it over, on the other side was a halogen lamp. I'm saying, I swear to God, I'm saying God is good, good is God. The halogen lamp caught on fire and a big flame went right up from the bush. And this soldier came out of his chair. He was just white as a ghost and he is going, oh my God. Oh my God! And you know, I totally forgot about his spiritual experience. I'm worried about my house burning down. So I'm going, oh my God, you know, outside the lamp. You know, I'm trying to get everything outside. So we got the bush out and the lamp out, and we came back because it was just like chaos in there. And by the time we all sat down, this man is still white as a ghost. And all of us, we went, oh my God, you know, that was a spiritual experience for the whole room. It was a spiritual experience for all of us. But the real fun part about this particular group of soldiers were so transformed when they went back to Fort Gordon, they started bussing them over to our house. So now every Wednesday we have a big prison bus that drives in front of our house on this little cul-de-sac, and all these big burly soldiers get off. And, you know, and the bus, you know, it used to stay there, but it got a little complicated with all of our neighbors, so now the bus goes and parks in the grocery parking lot, and then it comes back and he picks these guys up about 3 hours later. And, you know, all the neighbors are kind of, you know, want to know what's going on, so we just kind of allude to the fact that maybe we're having a Bible study or something like that. Because I know some of them have walked by in the window and seen these guys on their knees when we're saying the third step prayer. But, you know, the point of that is that, you know, I would have missed out on that. If I had let that surgery keep me in bed, I would have missed out on it, because that was a spiritual experience for me. You know, I got to see the lights go on in his eyes, and I didn't feel my stitches. I didn't feel my pain. I was so high that night, you know, it was that natural high that you can only get from God feeling that hole. And I was good for a week. You know, I was good for a week. And I would have missed out. If I had let that surgery keep me down, I would have missed out, because that was just such a gift. It was just such a gift. And another thing that happened to me, another time I'd had a surgery, I was working with this girl named Vivian. And I have shared this story many times for many years, because it was right after I moved to Georgia. I was working with this woman named Vivian, and Vivian's 9-year-old daughter died in a car accident as the direct result of her mom's alcoholism. And instead of taking responsibility, Vivian drank for another 14 years. She blamed God. It was God's fault that her daughter died. And after I started working with Vivian, after she finally came into Alcoholics Anonymous, we got up to step 8, and I had her list Tina at the very top of her list of amends to make. And this is the honest to God truth. She didn't have a clue that she was responsible. It was so shocking for her to take responsibility for her daughter's death. And so I instructed her, in the big book it says if you can't meet him face to face, you write him an honest letter. So I instructed her to write her daughter a letter. And this was the first surgery that I had in this long series of surgeries, and it was probably the hardest surgery, and I was very, very ill from this surgery, and Vivian was suicidal, because we had done this step work before I went in for the surgery, but after she took responsibility for her daughter's death, she became quite suicidal, and I just knew that we had to make these amends no matter what. We had to do it, we had to do it now, and so she wrote this beautiful letter to her daughter, and in this letter she invited her daughter's spirit to stay with her, to help her help other mothers recover so that more children don't have to die of this disease. And we went to Columbia, South Carolina, and we had to find the grave. She never even saw her daughter's grave, because she was in the hospital for over a year with her own injuries. So we had to find her daughter's grave, and a lot of things happened at the cemetery, at the gravesite. She read this letter. She buried her AA chip, and this cool breeze came. It was about 105 degrees out there because it was in June, and we looked at the date of her death. She didn't even know the date of her death, and we were there almost like within one day of the day that her daughter died. And this cool breeze came, and it was just blowing around us. None of the trees were blowing. My hair was blowing back, her hair was blowing back, but we looked around, and the trees weren't blowing, and the temperature dropped about from 105 down to 80 degrees. And it stayed that way until after she read the letter and she buried the chip. And then the breeze stopped, and at that point, a little ladybug came, and this little ladybug flew on Vivian. And that was a very meaningful thing to Vivian, because when her daughter was alive, ladybugs were her very favorite thing. And so she was just mesmerized neither of us thought the spirit was in the ladybug. We just, to her, it was just a very meaningful thing. And she sat there with her daughter's memory for about 20 minutes, and at the very end, just before she got up to come in the car, she said she heard her daughter's voice saying, "Mom, you have to get on with your life." And so what happened with that is we both started collecting ladybugs. We started collecting ladybugs in the memory of Tina, and in the memory of all the innocent children of alcoholic parents. Children are innocent, and children of alcoholic parents suffer. And so it's in their memory that we collect these ladybugs. And we could write a book. We're starting to collect stories on ladybugs since I've been sharing this at the podium, and she shares it too. And I don't always share it. Now that I've got the burning bush, I don't always share it. But just something recent has happened. That's why I'm sharing it tonight. We could write a book on the miracles that have happened just because of this little teeny story. An insignificant little ladybug. So many wonderful things have happened. I was in Missouri a couple months ago, and this little girl came up to me, and she said, "Are you Michael?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I just have to tell you, I have to tell you something that happened to me over a year ago." She said, "Somebody handed me your tape." And she said, "I listened to it, and I really loved the ladybug story. I really loved it." But she said she really didn't have any children. So, she loved the story, but it really didn't mean that much to her. But she was also at the jumping off place, and she was trying to commit suicide or whether to drink again. And she had some other disorders aside from alcoholism. But anyway, so she made the decision that she was just going to end it all. And she went down, and this is the next day after just listening to my tape. She went down under a bridge where no one would find her. And she had a bottle of alcohol, and she had razor blades. And she took the razor blade to slice her wrist, and a ladybug flew on her wrist right where the razor blade was. And because she had just heard that tape, She didn't cut her wrist, and she went and she called her sponsor. And by the time she met me, she had over a year of sobriety. And just there's so many little stories like that that just seem so little, but they're really so magnificent. You know, what God can do is just beyond my wildest dreams. It's just absolutely beyond my wildest dreams. Anyway, when I crawled through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous over 22 years ago, I had a formal ninth grade education. I didn't know how to work. I lived on welfare. I was reduced to prostitution, and I was a thief. And all of that was before I took that first drink at the age of 25. I really want to welcome the newcomers, and I like newcomers to know that the absolute highest you get in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober. It is not a speaker. And I'd like to welcome those of you who are not so new but are having difficulty with this program. I saw a sign in an AA club that always gave me a lot of hope. And that sign says that you're not a failure unless you quit trying. And I believe that to be true. So please, whatever you do, just keep coming back. But I was told early on in this program that this program is not for spectators. This is a program of action, and those actions are the 12 steps as laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Dr. Bob, one of our co-founders, said if you simmer those 12 steps into two words, those two words would be love and service. And before he said that, he said, I want to emphasize the simplicity of this program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes that are interesting to the scientific mind but have little to do with our actual AA work. And I see a lot of things drifting in and out of AA today. They might not be Freudian, but they're just as useless. And what they do... And what they do is they just complicate this very simple program. I love to talk about Dr. Bob because I come from a line of sponsorship that comes down from Dr. Bob. And basically, we're big book thumpers. We do the steps according to the big book. And this is where you need to understand the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the one thing a little bit different than in the big book that we do is when we do a step five, and sometimes with my girls, I do four and five with them at the same time because, I mean, they just can't do it. Their thinking is so out there, they just can't sit down and just do a fourth step. So I'll bring them over and help them with their fourth step. So we're doing four and five at the same time. But anytime I listen to a fifth step, we immediately do six, seven, and eight because that's how it was done with me. And in the big book, it says, after you do your fifth step, returning home, you take the book down from the shelf. I mean, hopefully your book's not on the shelf, you know, hopefully. But anyway, it says take the book down from the shelf and you look over those first five proposals. You spend an hour with God. And so we do that, you know, we do that. But home can be in the heart. And so I have anybody that does a fifth step with me stay in my AA room for that period of time and look at their book and the first five proposals and see if they've left anything out before we go on to step six. And then we do six, seven, and eight. And that's where it is that if you know the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we had the Oxford group, we broke off from a religious affiliation called the Oxford group. And the drunks in the Oxford group took that set of principles and gave them numbers. And so there were like six steps. But they had actions that they took. And so step three was the moral inventory. But at the moral inventory, they took the actions of going over character defects, and they went over them at great length. They didn't just brush over them and say, oh, God knows what they are, and when he's ready, he's going to remove them. No. They went over them with their sponsor at great length because they believed that you might drink over some of your character defects. The sponsor said the prayer with you to have those defects removed, and then the sponsor helped you make your list of amends, ways and means of making these amends. And so that's where, you know, the 12 and 12 really comes in handy. First of all, the group of drunks that were writing the book really wanted, they were in a hurry to get that book written. And so Bill took those actions that they did at the moral inventory. He wanted to stretch the steps into 12 for spiritual reasons. So he took those actions that are now 6, 7, and 8, and he just kind of threw them in the book. So there's only two paragraphs, very short paragraphs on steps 6 and 7. I don't know if you've, hopefully you've read it and you've noticed that, but it really doesn't go over them at great length. And that's where the 12 and 12 really comes in. It really enhances the big book. And I don't believe the 12 and 12 was ever meant to replace the big book. I believe it was always intended to enhance the big book. And step 6 is my favorite step in the 12 and 12. And what Bill says about step 6 is he says, God will not render you white as snow without your cooperation. He says, the man that repeatedly works on his other defects of character grows in the image of his Creator. And then he addresses the fact that some of our defects of character are harder to remove than alcoholism. He says alcoholism is not a natural instinct. So when you're ready, God can just get in there and remove it. But some of our other defects of character are natural instincts that have gone amok, and there's no way God can remove a natural instinct because he gave them to us for survival. So it says that sometimes we might have to settle for patient improvement. But I'm so thankful that I had that kind of sponsorship, because if I didn't, I would probably be drunk today. At the very top of my list, my sponsor told me I had self-pity. I mean, I prostituted and I stole, and she told me the top of my list was self-pity. I didn't get it, you know, and I told her, well, I feel like my self-pity's justified. Look at my childhood. You know, and she told me in the most loving way, she said, Michael, alcoholics cannot afford justified self-pity. And then she gave me that old cliche, poor me, poor me, pour me another drink. And I can tell you today that self-pity's been totally removed, and it has been replaced with overwhelming gratitude. But two of the other things that were near the top of my list was prostitution and stealing. And I truly know that if I didn't quit those things at once, I would have drank. And I have a lot of shame about this, but the last time I prostituted, I was 6 months sober, and I was on my ninth step. And I had a spiritual experience behind that, and with my sponsor's help, I knew that if I did it again, I would get drunk. So I gave it up at 6 months of sobriety. And then stealing. Stealing was very hard for me. It was habit for me to steal. I mean, it was just habit. So what I had to do with stealing is I had to call my sponsor. In the morning, I'd commit, for today I will not steal. And at night, I would call her and I'd say, I haven't stolen anything today. And that obsession to steal has been removed. It has been totally removed. I can't believe I was ever that person, but I was, and I haven't stolen in such a long time. It's just really important that I get up here and I remind myself that I used to do that, because I truly, if I walk away from here and I don't share about it, I'll forget that that's the kind of stuff that I used to do. The one thing that flares up on me, and some of these character defects will flare up on us, is I have an eating disorder. You know, I have an eating disorder, and I've had periods. I had like 12 years of real recovery with my eating, where I was free from food, fat, and diet, and I was very thin, and just out of nowhere, it just flared up on me. But, you know, I know what to do about it. I know one thing, that God is not going to strike me thin without my cooperation. I am going to have to stop eating, and I'm going to have to do a few things. And I know what those things are because I've done them before. But, you know, the big book says if you're not willing, pray for the willingness. And that's where I'm at right now. I'm praying for the willingness because it's, you know, when it's so obvious that I'm standing up here and you know I'm practicing a character defect. I mean, everyone who has seen me a few years ago, you know I have gained a lot of weight. And it's shameful for me to stand up here and say, obviously, I'm not doing step six, but I really am. I really am doing step six because I am addressing a lot of other things. And then sometimes I get a character defect under wrap, and then a new one pops up. And, you know, and I talked about it earlier, the one that popped up on me in sobriety that I never used to have except for with my mom was being judgmental and opinionated. You know, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't have enough self-worth to have a judgment or to have an opinion. And after I started working these steps, and I gained some self-esteem, and how you get self-esteem in Alcoholics Anonymous is do esteemable acts. Do esteemable acts is how you get self-esteem. But so I've got this wonderful recovery, and I'm 12 to 15 years sober, and oh, now I'm starting to get judgmental and opinionated, and I'm judging people, and I'm being opinionated, and I'll be darned if I didn't have to start walking in their shoes, experiencing their experience, to get over the judgment one more time. And so today I am just so aware of that. And that doesn't mean I'm perfect and I don't start judging. I mean, I do, but I immediately start praying for God. Okay, let's get out of this real fast because I don't want to have to experience it. But Bill does say we do have to make judgments. There's a difference between making a judgment of what you want to be like and what you don't want to be like, and then being judgmental and opinionated, you know. So it's a balancing act for me. Anyway, In the big book, under doctor's opinion, it tells me that many types of alcoholics do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. So I'm here tonight to tell you that I'm one of those alcoholics. In fact, so is my mom. We both tried to recover from this disease through the psychiatric effort. Different times, but we went to the same psychiatrist. Of course, the result was nil. But the good news is that today, that very same psychiatrist is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom and I both tried to recover from this disease through the religious effort, different times in different congregations, but the result was the same, and believe it or not, today that very same minister that counseled me is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to joke around and say, I think we drove these two men to drink. But the truth is, and this is the truth, my mom slept with the psychiatrist and I slept with the minister. And that's why I'm usually invited to be the Sunday morning spiritual speaker. One thing I know for sure, though, is that psychiatrist, that minister, and myself are perfect examples that AA works when other things fail. A little bit about my background. First of all, I'm Irish, German, and Cherokee, and I'm illegitimate. And being born out of wedlock today is just not a big deal. But when I was a little girl growing up, it was. And my childhood is pretty appalling. So in my mom's defense, I want to tell you a little bit about her childhood, because as bad as my childhood was, my mom's was worse. And this program gave me the ability to have a very loving relationship with my mom, even though she couldn't quit drinking. I lost my mom 9 years ago. She died of lung cancer. And I had the opportunity to practice love and service at home. My sister and I took my mom home. We had hospice come in. And my mom got to die with a little bit of dignity. I had the ability to get in bed with my mom, hold her all night, and just love her unconditionally. And I had to watch her drink on top of morphine up until the day she could no longer swallow. And it's probably one of the hardest things that I've ever done. But one thing I learned from this whole experience is that my whole life growing up, I was so focused on the things I hated about my mom, the things I didn't want to be like, that I missed all of her wonderful qualities. My mom had a lot of wonderful qualities, and I really miss her a lot today. But my mom came from an alcoholic background, and when she was 13, her mother was murdered in a drunken brawl. A drunk slit my grandmother's throat. So that left my mom out on the streets at the age of 13 of trying to raise herself. At the age of 14, she had her first baby, which she gave up for adoption. And then she had me, and she did everything in her power to keep me. She later met this man, got married, had 3 boys. We all moved to California. That marriage soon ended in divorce, and my stepfather moved back to Colorado. So that left my mom in California trying to raise 4 little kids, and we were raised on welfare. We were raised in extreme, extreme poverty, always having lights, gas, telephones turned off, always being evicted, even sleeping in cars. And then I had to deal with my mom's alcoholism, I had to deal with her prostitution, and I had to deal with all of her suicide attempts. When I was 12, my mom got pregnant again, and this time she sent my 3 younger brothers to live with their real dad in Colorado. Now, my 3 brothers are my very best friends. When you're sleeping in cars and you're always being evicted, you don't have an opportunity to make friends. So my brothers were my friends. So I feel like at the age of 12, I already had all these feelings that I later brought with me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And those feelings were of low self-worth, low self-esteem, not equal to and just not good enough. And that was a direct result of all that poverty. The drunken psychiatrist pointed out to me that I had issues of abandonment. You know, I never knew my real dad. My stepdad went away. My 3 brothers went away. My mom's always trying to kill herself. And because of some other childhood experiences, I would say I'm a fear-based person. I've always been afraid of people, places, and things. And the 2 very important things I learned when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, first of all, I learned that feelings are not facts. And the things I used to think about myself were not the truth. And best of all, I learned how to walk through fear. And I learned that every time I walk through fear, I'm actually exercising faith. And this last 12 and a half years, I've walked through one of my biggest fears, and it's getting on airplanes. It took me 12 and a half years of sobriety to finally get on an airplane, and I found out that I'm not even afraid of flying. I'm afraid of crashing. My sponsor told me I'd better be clear on what my fear was when I was asking God to remove it. But I hear a lot of things in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not necessarily in the big book. And the one thing I used to hear in meetings all the time is that you could not have fear and faith at the same time. That if you had fear, you didn't have any faith. And I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in my program. Because I had worked these steps as hard as I could work these steps. And I've had spiritual experiences, but I still had all this fear. And I finally went up to one of these guys that was always making that statement. And I went up to him and I said, what am I doing wrong in my program? Why do I still have all this fear? And he said to me in the most arrogant way, he says, well, it sounds to me like you haven't taken a thorough third step. Well, today I know the third step's only a decision. And to follow up on that decision, to actually do a thorough third step, is you have to take those actions of 4 through 9. That's actually how you turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Have you ever asked yourself, how do you do that? How do you do that? Is you pick up the pen and you start on your fourth step. That's the process. That's the process of turning your will and your life over to God, is 4 through 9. And how you continue on a daily basis turning your will and your life over to the care of God is you live in 10, 11, and 12. Step 10 is really a daily 4 through 9. Actually, if you read it in the big book, it's really a daily 4 through 12. And anyway, so I finally went up to one of these old-timers in the Long Beach area that was really instrumental in my sobriety, and I was crying on his shoulder about this fear and faith thing and what am I doing wrong in my program. And he said, Michael, nowhere in the big book does it tell you you cannot have fear and faith at the same time. And he took me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he pointed out a sentence to me. And this sentence is on page 68, and it's under the fear inventory. And that sentence says, all men of faith have courage. All men of faith have courage. And then he pointed out to me, you don't need courage unless you're afraid. And then he took me down to the bottom of that paragraph, and it gives you that little fear prayer where it says, God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you'd have me be. And I'm always directed to work with another person, whether they're in the program or out of the program. I'm always directed to help somebody. That's how I get on airplanes. When my husband's not with me, I'm at the airport, and I'm looking for little old ladies I can help with their baggage. And sometimes they don't want help, and they think I'm stealing their bag. And I'm begging them to please let me help you. But those are the things I do that help me get on an airplane, because I still have fear. Anyway, the very last sentence in that paragraph says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. It does not say at once we outgrow fear. It says we commence to outgrow fear. So here I am, 22 years sober, and I'm still commencing. But that's okay, because that's in the big book too. It falls under steps 10 and 11. You know, in step 10, it says that you're to continue watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And it tells me that it's not an overnight matter and that it should continue for a lifetime. So it tells me that in step 10, and it tells me that I try to do it all through the day. But then when you turn the page and you're in step 11, it tells you another time to do it. It says to do it on retiring at night. And there's a paragraph there that has 7 questions in it. And in the big book, steps 10, 11, and 12 are really commingled. And so even though it falls under step 11, that's how I do my 10th step at night. On retiring at night, I answer those 7 questions. And one of them says, were you selfish, dishonest, resentful, or afraid? It says, do you owe an apology? Have you kept something to yourself that you need to share with another person? What could you have done better? That is such a powerful question for me to answer, because sometimes I can't change my behavior unless I know what I can change it to. But it also tells you, were you kind and loving towards all? So it's not just looking for the bad, it's also looking for the good. So I really try to look at my day, good and bad, and I answer those 7 questions. And I do pretty good. If I do that every night, I stay in a pretty good place. And I can tell when I'm traveling and I get to bed too late and I don't do that, I usually have a pretty crummy day the next day. But and then the next paragraph after that is on awakening. And on awakening, it says that's where you do your prayer and your meditation. So I do my formal prayer meditation in the morning when I wake up, and I pray all through the day. And I've already shared with you what I do in the form of Step 12. But anyway, so when I was 13, my mom did have this baby. And I had to learn how to be a mom, and I didn't even know how to be a kid. My mom's alcoholism took her out of the home. She was never, ever around, and I had full responsibility of this little baby. And this little baby is sleeping in a dresser drawer. I eventually had to potty train her, bottle break her. I'm failing in school because I can't get to school because of this responsibility. Now, the truth is, after doing my inventory, I found out I hated school anyway. When I went to school, I was either an object of pity around my peers, or I was teased about the way I dressed and teased about my hair. So specifically to get out of my home life, at the age of 15, I got married. And the man I married was 18. He lived in the neighborhood. He came from a similar background. And I have such a colorful past that I like to brag about this. I want everyone here to know, when I got married at the age of 15, I was not pregnant. At the age of 15, I had high morals and high values. I truly did. I had these two TV shows I used to watch. And most of you are too young to remember these shows, especially newcomers coming in. But it was Donna Reed and Father Knows Best. Not very realistic, but they were good for me. And these were family shows. And because of these shows, I had these high morals and high values my whole life growing up. All I knew is when I grew up, I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my mom, and I didn't want a prostitute like my mom. So when I got married at the age of 15, I had this wild idea that I was Miss Donna Reed marrying Mr. Father Knows Best, and unfortunately it didn't turn out that way, and I believe the man I married was an alcoholic. One indication, his name was Johnny Walker. I want to share a story with you about that sister of mine, the one that slept in the dresser drawer, because when I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to blame my alcoholism on my mom's alcoholism, and I blamed the way I turned out on the way I was raised. And after I got sober in this program, I took a good look at that sister of mine because she came from the very same background. In fact, I would say her childhood was worse than mine because my mom's disease had progressed. And my sister was literally forced to move out of the house at the age of 16. So she quit school and she moved out. But what she did is she took that high school equivalency test, and she had to take it 3 times until she finally passed it. With this test under her belt, under a special youth program, she went to work for the city of Long Beach. At the age of 26, she retired from the city of Long Beach. She took her 10 years retirement pay. She bought her own business. She later married the head traffic engineer for the city of Long Beach, and 10 years ago, at the age of 30, my sister was awarded Woman Entrepreneur of the Year. Now, even today, sometimes I still don't get it. Same mom, same background, but different reactions. And the difference is my sister is not an alcoholic. My sister is not bodily and mentally different from her fellows. My sister reacts to life situations differently than I do. So today, I get to accept responsibility, and I can no longer blame all those people, places, and things. Yes, I am an alcoholic, and I do have a disease, but today, I have a solution, and for me, part of my solution is being accountable for my actions, my past actions, and my present actions. So anyway, at the age of 15, I did get married. At the age of 17, I had a baby. At the age of 18, I had to get out of this marriage because this man took me through a whole new phase of alcoholism I never experienced with my mom. And it's called physical abuse, and he never abused me unless he was drinking. But he abused me to the point of cutting me up with a knife, and I had to have surgery to repair the damage. So I got out of that marriage at the age of 18, and I feel like that's when I started on the road of being everything I swore I'd never be, doing everything I swore I'd never do. Hadn't even taken a drink of alcohol yet. I always intuitively knew if I took a drink, I'd be an alcoholic. But it started out with me being a single mother living on welfare. My whole life growing up like that, I swore when I grew up I wasn't going to live like that, and there I was. Now, on page 23 in the big book, it says the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. So we're talking about the main problem being the mental obsession and not the physical allergy. So I know for me, I practiced my disease of alcoholism way before I ever took that first drink, because I've always had the mental obsession part of this disease. And I practiced it in the form of compulsive overeating. I would shove food in my mouth instead of alcohol. And then I discovered that wonderful world of diet pills. And that's back in the days when doctors gave really good amphetamines. Methadrine, dexedrine. So I went on this diet for 16 years. When I finally took that drink at the age of 25, I immediately had the physical allergy. From that very first drink, I had the phenomenon of craving. From that very first drink, I had a personality change. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you read about that in the Big Book. The Big Book refers to that as a real alcoholic. And I personally am so physically allergic to alcohol. When I consume alcohol, I break out in a rash, welts, and hives all over my body. And I was always too drunk to have a clue that that wasn't normal. And if I'd had a clue, it wouldn't have made a difference. But from that very first drink, I drank morning, noon, and night, and I did not draw a sober breath from the age of 25 to the age of 31, and that is not an exaggeration. I had a huge spiritual experience way before I ever got to this program, and this was equivalent to the one that Bill had in Bill's story. Now, in the Big Book, it says, as a result of a spiritual awakening, you'll have a change in psyche, a change in attitude. It says you'll have this huge emotional displacement rearrangement. And this spiritual experience I had was not enough for me to achieve that, and I believe it's because I did not have a plan of action to go with it. But it was enough for me to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So what I did with this experience is I went to this church, I counseled with this minister, I told him all about my spiritual experience, and I shared with him all my character defects and all my shortcomings. And this man assured me if I got really active in this church and I read all these inspirational books and I did all this positive thinking and all these affirmations, that I could be everything that I ever wanted to be. After I got to this program, I heard a speaker at the podium say, if you're alcoholic, you cannot think your way into right actions. He said, if you're alcoholic, you have to act your way into right thinking. And I am absolute proof of that, because I got really active in that church. I even became the secretary of that church. And I struggled reading those books because I could barely read. I did all that positive thinking, constant affirmations. And the only thing that resulted is I ended up having a torrid affair with this minister. And it absolutely infuriated his wife. And the rest of the congregation wasn't too excited about it either. But well, they were excited, but it wasn't the right kind of excited. But the one thing I'm going to share with you now is the one thing I thought I'd take to the grave with me. As secretary of that church, it was my job to handle the money, and when I handled that money, I stole part of that money. Now, at that point in my life, I knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt, my only hope was God. Because I just had a spiritual experience. And I turned to God for help. And I ended up seducing his minister and ripping off his church. So I truly know the feeling of hopelessness that they talk about in the Big Book. And I'm going to share two stories with you while I'm on the subject of the minister. And I like to share this first story because it's the first time I was ever able to laugh at any part of my alcoholism. I always heard that laughter was healing, but I always thought my story was just much too serious. And when I got here, I used to hang out in the very back of the room, and I have a friend named Teddy. Teddy calls the back of the room the half-measure section or the denial section. Now, I didn't hang out back there for either of those reasons. I hung out back there because I couldn't read very well. And I was terrified that they would ask me to read something. I literally could not say the word anonymity for over 6 months. So I always hide out in the back of the room. And in California, it's very theatrical, so we have some very funny speakers. And speakers would get up at the podium, and they'd share their story, and everybody would laugh. And at first, I was just absolutely incapable of laughing. But one day, after I had a couple years of sobriety under my belt, I caught myself in the back of the room laughing too. But right after having this huge belly laugh, I found myself thinking, well, that might be funny for you, but there is nothing, absolutely nothing in my background I could ever laugh at. And then about 11 years ago, I was speaking in Seal Beach, California. It was just my second time to ever give an AA talk. And my daughter wanted to come hear me. Now, my daughter got to this program for the first time when she was 15 years old. And at the age of 18, I already shared with you her tragedy, and she lost her sobriety. So she was in and out of AA because she turned her back on God. And I want you to know today my daughter is 36 years old, and she has 37 years old, and she has 9 years of Big Book sobriety. And I'm very thankful to you for that. Because of myself, I could not do it. I hate to say she had Big Book sobriety is what I should say, because she's kind of drifting off now, and I'm a little bit concerned because I did that at 10 years of sobriety. School became more important and work became more important, and I almost picked up a drink. And I had to recommit to this program and work at it the same way I do now, and I have for the last 12 years. But I see that happening to her, so I've got some concerns, but I just have to know that she's God's kid, and I have to stay out of it. You know, I just absolutely have to stay out of it. But anyway, so she's sober now. But when I was given this talk 11 years ago, she was trying to get sober one more time, and she heard I was talking. And so, and she wanted to come hear me. So before the meeting, she brought some of her program girlfriends over to my house. We had coffee. We were going to go to the meeting together. But when we were having coffee, my daughter proceeded to tell all of her girlfriends my drunkalog. And it was just the first time I was ever able to laugh at anything. And so anything that might make you laugh tonight, she gave me that night. And I keep it in my story because my first talk was so serious and so sad, I wanted to commit suicide. So I mean, I was just like, oh, God. But my daughter gave me some stuff to lighten it up. So anyway, of course, she's telling these girls all about the minister. You know, and I just never thought about how some of this stuff looks through the eyes of a 9-year-old. She was 9 years old when I'm seeing this minister. And I'm dragging her off to church every day, and she's learning things like the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule. I'm constantly preaching all this religious stuff to her. She comes home from school at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She opens the bedroom door, and there, naked in bed with her mom, was the married minister of the church. Now, when she first said this to her friends, I felt all this shame, all this embarrassment, and I looked at my daughter in the most sympathetic way. I said, God, honey, that had to be a terrible shock. And my daughter just looked at me and she said, no, Mom, I don't know what shocked me the most, seeing that minister naked or seeing his artificial leg on the floor. Until that time, I totally forgot he had an artificial leg, and it was a huge leg. I don't know how I forgot it. I guess it's because in ways that are important, he was not disabled. After I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I started working those 12 steps, I found for me the most important step was step 9. Now, step 9 is the amends step, the step where we make restitution. And I recommend you do the first 8 steps before you get to step 9. I know some people come into this program, they take a look at step 9, it's so scary. They turn around and they leave. Other people come in and start right in on step 9 and make very inappropriate amends. And I believe the steps are in order for a reason, and I believe this one in particular should be taken with the advice of a sponsor. But I call step 9 the freedom step. This is the step that truly freed me from the bondage of my past. And it's just not a coincidence that in the Big Book those promises come after step 9. It says before you're halfway through, you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. It says you won't regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, and so on and so on. And I did not have to wait to get halfway through step 9. That happened to me with my very first amends, and that was going back to that church and telling that minister I used to steal from the church funds, and he told me he knew that. And I set up a payment schedule to pay back the church. Then I had to tell him that I used to steal out of his wallet when he was in the shower, and he told me he did not know that. So I made restitution to him. But the neat thing about this experience is he shared with me at that time, by the time I got to him, I mean, he knew exactly what I was doing, because by the time I got to him, he had 2 years of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When he lost his leg in that motorcycle accident, he was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and he actually died on the operating table. He had one of those near-death experiences, which for him was his spiritual experience. And that's what led him into ministerial school and becoming a minister. And even he could not get sober in church. And I'm not putting down churches. And I'm not putting down the psychiatric effort, because the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous makes it real clear that this program owes a lot to both of these institutions. And in the big book it says, if you need professional help, do not hesitate to seek it. But I have to tell you, for me, it's all about that miracle that happens when one drunk reaches out to another drunk. So I've been kicked out of this church. I'm 27 years old. I'm full on into my drinking. I'm living in an apartment I'm being evicted from, and this is my normal MO. I'm always being evicted. Lights and gas had been turned off for a long time, but I still had a telephone. It was one of my working priorities. I got this call at 11 o'clock at night, and I could not believe the man on the other end of this phone. It was my real dad. Now, I barely knew this man's name was on my birth certificate, and he wanted to make amends for not being in my life. He wanted to get to know me, and he wanted to get to know my daughter, so he offered me an opportunity to move to Colorado to get to know his whole family. And I didn't want to go. I didn't have any desire to get to know him, but mostly I didn't want to move to the snow. But at that point in my life, I didn't have anywhere to go except for out on the streets. And deep down inside, I had this little hope, if I did this geographic, maybe I could change. So I made that move to Colorado. I lived there for 3 months, and in that 3 month period, this man and his family could not wait to kick me out of the state of Colorado. In that 3 month period, I ended up having affairs with the bus drivers on the way over there, getting pregnant, having an abortion, falling down the stairs and breaking my leg, ripping off his medicine cabinet, ripping off his booze cabinet, ripping off his money. So they literally kicked me out of the state of Colorado. I'm going to tell you how I broke my leg. Obviously, I was drunk. And in the neighborhood where I lived, the liquor stores closed at 12, and I didn't have a car, so I had to go to the stores close to me. And I had to make my final liquor run, and it had been they had ice storms and all that, and even at that point it was even snowing, and I'm walking down the stairs. I live in a second floor apartment, and the stairs are very icy. I'm hanging onto the railing with my right hand, and my 9-year-old daughter's on the left side of me trying to hold me up. And all of a sudden, I looked up at another second floor apartment because the door just opened. And out of that door walked a priest. I don't know what he was doing there, but he had the collar, the robe. He is definitely, definitely a man of God. And I am very angry at God. I'm angry at God because I just seduced his minister and ripped off his church. So now I'm mad at God. And I looked up at that priest. I let go of the railing with my right hand. I flipped up my middle finger and I said, F you, God. And I immediately fell down the stairs and broke my leg. Now, my daughter told me that is the day she started believing in a punishing God. And today my daughter and I both know it had nothing to do with God. I fell because I was drunk. But anyway, my real dad was second on my list of amends to make when I started making my amends. And I wrote this man a letter, and I told him I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to make restitution for my behavior up there. And I sent him a check, trying to set up a payment schedule to pay him back. And basically what he and the family did is they sent me the check back with a little note that said they didn't want my money, and they never wanted to hear from me again. I was working with a sponsor, so of course I stayed sober. But I really did want to make these amends. And so with my sponsor's encouragement, on every Father's Day and on every birthday, I would send him an appropriate card. And I would tell him that I was still sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still wanted to make restitution. I did this for 6 or 7 years, and he would never, ever acknowledge me. And finally, 1985 or 1986, I got a reply back. And I cannot tell you how excited I was when I saw the return address on that envelope. And I ripped open the envelope, and the only thing that was in it was a picture of his tombstone and the obituary out of the newspaper. He had just died. And that was the family's way of telling me not to bother trying anymore. And there are no words to express the kind of pain I felt. You would have thought I knew him my whole life, and I didn't, but I took it real, real hard. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous pointed out to me I don't make amends for approval. The big book tells me I don't make amends to be forgiven. I make amends to clean up my side of the street. I make amends to stay sober. So all I can tell you is that the actions I took worked. Because not once, not even once, was I ever tempted to drink over that rejection. I'm just so sorry he did not get to know the person I am today, because I know he would have been proud. So I've been kicked out of this church, and now I'm kicked out of the state. I'm living back in Long Beach, California, across the street from Franklin Junior High. My daughter's now 14 years old, and she's running with a very dangerous gang. I'm doing awful, humiliating, embarrassing things to my daughter, but I'm not only embarrassing my daughter, I was embarrassing this entire gang. This is the honest to God truth. I was living in another apartment I was being evicted from. Lights, gas, and telephone had all been turned off for a long time. I'm hiding out from the landlord because he's trying to serve me an eviction notice. So I always kept my drapes closed so he wouldn't know I was home. So I have no electricity. My drapes are always closed. My apartment's always dark. My apartment is so dark that now I'm seeing evil spirits. And unless you've seen them, they're hard to describe. But these evil spirits would do things to me like follow me around the house, and then I in turn would do things like crawl out of the house on my hands and knees, butt naked, across the street to the school ground, and warn my daughter and her gang friends not to come home. The house was possessed with evil spirits. And this is the kind of stuff I did that makes me wish to God I was a blackout drinker. But nothing I'm telling you is hearsay. I'm not a blackout drinker. I get to remember. All the neighbors felt sorry for my daughter. They would feed her. They would hide her out. Sometimes they would even feed me. Once we were next door at the neighbor's house, she was feeding both of us. And on her counter, she had a bottle of 100-proof vodka. Something happened outside. My daughter and my neighbor went to check it out, and I lagged behind because I wanted to grab that vodka and drink some down real fast and not get caught. I was always promising my daughter I wouldn't drink. So I just grabbed that bottle, and I started drinking right out of the bottle, and I don't know how much or how fast I drank it, but I do know it was enough to stop my respiratory system. At that point, I stopped breathing, and I can remember the sensation I couldn't breathe, and that's the last thing I remember. I don't remember the paramedics. I don't remember being rushed to the hospital. I don't remember being brought back to life. By the time I had any memory, I woke up or came to, or whatever you call it, with both my hands strapped down to a hospital bed. A nurse had just slapped me in the face because I was screaming obscenities at her because I was a very mean and vile drunk. But this experience did get my attention. This time, I'd almost died under the influence of alcohol, and it scared me. You know, I didn't want to die out there. I didn't want to do to my daughter what my mom had done to me. All of her suicide attempts, all the police holding me by the waist as I'm trying to get to my mom as they're wheeling her off on a stretcher. I just didn't want to do that to my daughter. So I finally started listening to my daughter, because my daughter used to tell me on a daily basis, she would say, "Mom, it's the alcohol, and if you wouldn't drink, you wouldn't do those things." She said, "Just smoke pot." So, this is my only experience smoking pot. I don't have any friends of my own, so I'm smoking this pot with my daughter and her friends. And afterwards, we're walking down the street, and I have on these tight, tight jeans, and I have both my hands stuck down in my pockets. And I don't know if I tripped over a crack or I tripped over my own foot, but I tripped, and I just started to go down. I don't know if any of you have been on pot, but for me, it was different. First of all, I had the feeling that I was in slow motion. I had the sensation that the cement was coming up at my face, and no matter what I did, and I can remember this so clear, I tried really hard. I could not get my hands out of my pockets. So you've got a picture of a grown woman laying with her face smashed in cement, her hands are still sticking out of her pockets, and all those kids standing around me were laughing hysterically. They were absolutely hysterical. I guess when you smoke pot, you laugh a lot. I don't know. I wasn't laughing. I was feeling a lot. And I'm laying there in pain, and I can hear all these people laughing. And as I heard that laughter, I had that moment of clarity. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that pot was not the answer. And I went right back to my drinking, and I drank at the same pace for quite a while longer. So I finally reached a point you read about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's on page 151, and it talks about facing the four hideous horsemen. It wasn't all the awful things I did out there that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't crawling out on my hands and knees to a school ground butt naked. It wasn't drinking vodka down so fast that I died. None of those things were enough to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. What got me here were the feelings. those hideous four horsemen. I woke up on my front room floor one more time. And one more time I felt those feelings of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I was laying in a puddle of fluid. I don't know what the fluid was. I took the first three steps, and I didn't know what the first three steps were. But I knew that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had never, ever been manageable. I already believed that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I just didn't think he would because of what I had done to the church. And this was my way of turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I just got on my knees and I just said, God, please, I don't care how you do it, but please just get me sober. And I managed to get to a telephone. I called a prayer line that was affiliated with the church I had been in, and I asked them to pray for me. Because in my mind, I thought if God wouldn't listen to my prayers because of what I'd done to the church, maybe God would listen to their prayers. And they prayed for me for 30 days. And within 30 days, I was sober. And it's a series of God coincidences that landed me in my first meeting at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so physically sick from withdrawals, there's no way I would have made that meeting without a drink. And I ended up having two beers before the meeting. That's the last drink I ever had, and that was on November 10th, 1979. However, I don't celebrate my birthday till 3 months later because I continue to do those diet pills. AA has no opinion on the outside issues, right? That's one of our traditions, so I just kept taking those diet pills. But when I quit drinking, I started working those steps. You know, when I started working those steps, God revealed to me I wasn't sober if I was abusing those pills. So I gave those up January 23rd, 1980, and that's when I celebrate my sobriety date. I'm supposed to share with you what it was like, what happened to change me, and what I'm like today. And what happened to change me were the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what keeps me here are the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts. I want you to know what I looked like when I came to you. First of all, I was huge. I was very obese. I had all this wild, wild bleach blonde hair. I don't know if you've ever been drunk and tried to bleach your hair, but you do a thing called overlapping, and it causes your hair to break off. And then I'd be drunk at other times and fall asleep with bleach on my hair, so I had a few bald spots. And you know, when you're taking a lot of amphetamines, you scratch a lot. And so I had sores in those big bald spots. And then the last couple months, I didn't care at all, and I didn't bleach my hair. So I had big black roots, bald spots with sores in them, different lengths of broken off bleach blonde hair. My teeth were worn up to here, so it looked like I had no front teeth. I was always profusely sweating, and I had become an alcoholic woman that did not bathe. And I always wore a big purple sarapi to cover my body in hopes that you wouldn't see me. And that's what came to you November 10th, 1979. Anyway, I was 6 months sober. I was on my ninth step. My sponsor told me I had to get a job and be fully self-supporting through my own contributions, and I don't know how to work. And I went out there and I got my first job, and that's where I learned how to work. I learned things like how to get there every day, how to get there on time, how to not leave early, how to only take a 30-minute lunch break. I did not know how to do those things. I learned them here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I worked my first job 8 years full-time. I stayed another 2 years part-time after I'd taken another full-time position. So I was there for a total of 10 years. And in that first eight-year period, I went back to high school. I was not smart enough to pass a GED. I had to go back to high school. I went to night school, and I graduated from high school in 1985, and I was 36 years old. And I graduated with a cap, a gown, a real ceremony, and 450 18-year-olds. What I did for the next 6 years is I went to work for a musical theater corporation, and it was Equity. Equity means union, which means they dealt with big, big major stars. And I started out in the very bottom in the accounting department, and I went back to school. And within a period of time, I worked myself up to business manager of this multi-million dollar corporation. And as business manager, I dealt with millions of dollars. And this is the honest to God truth. When I got to this program, I didn't even know how many zeros were in $1 million. I have participated in union negotiations, and I've been invited into some of the homes of some of the most famous people you see on stage, screen, and TV. And even today, I'll see myself in a picture with a very famous person, and I just get overwhelmed. And I just think, how did I ever get from the gutters of Long Beach to being invited into some of these places? And how that happened is I worked the last part of that 12th step. and I applied these principles in all my affairs. I'm going to share one last story with you. I'm going to close, and it's how I came to terms with the God I have in my life today. I told you that my daughter was 15 years old when she first got sober. When she was 18 years old, she had 3 years of sobriety. She and her girlfriend were leaving an AA dance. They were in the parking lot of the dance. A man came up to him with a gun. He forced these two girls in the car at gunpoint, and he kidnapped them. He knocked the one girl unconscious and brutally raped my daughter for over 2 hours. And I absolutely hate the word rape, because rape sounds like it's just about sex. But rape is really about terror, and it's about violence. And the whole time this was going on, my daughter knew he was going to kill her anyway. She was so angry at God, it took her over 2 years to remember that she did say a quiet prayer to live. This man had a bottle of alcohol in his pocket. He was drinking throughout the whole ordeal. Thank God, because he got quite drunk. And at the point where he is forcing my daughter into the trunk of the car, somehow my daughter got the courage to at least make some kind of an effort to try to save her own life. And she caught him off guard. She slugged him in the face as hard as she could. He tripped. He fell down. The gun slid under the wheel. My daughter ran down the street naked, and she got away. At that point, he got back into the car, and he took off with the car with the other girl still in it. But later on down the road, he rolled her out into the street, so both girls lived. But the road of recovery was real hard, and it was real long. My daughter and I felt absolutely betrayed. How could God let this happen to us? We were both sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. How could God let this happen to us? We were working these 12 steps as hard as we could, and this is a spiritual program. But the hardest thing for me to deal with was a sentence in the Big Book. It used to be one of my favorite pages, and we're talking about the third edition. It's page 449, and it talks about acceptance. And I still like the part on acceptance, but that one sentence says, "Absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake." Clancy says, "Alcoholism is a disease of perception." I'm still an alcoholic. I still get my disease of perception because I perceive that to mean that if nothing in God's world happens by mistake, then that had to be an act of God. It had to be an act of God, and I wanted to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to leave God, because I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt I didn't want any part of a God that could operate like that. And thank God for this man named Bill Honeycutt. He was one of those old-timers that was so instrumental in my sobriety. He just took me by the hand and he said, "Michael, God is good, and good is God. And if it's not good, it's not of God." He said, "Man has free will. That man was acting on his free will, and your daughter was just a victim." He said, "If man didn't have free will, we wouldn't all be sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd all be perfect people." And when he told me that, I had a spiritual release, and I knew he was telling me the truth. And I love to hear my sponsor, Polly, share. She always talks about finding God deep within, and that's what it says in the Big Book. And on that same page, it says it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. And when I'm into fear and I'm into calamity, even today, I feel disconnected from my higher power. And that's when I so desperately, desperately need the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because if God is deep within me, then God is deep within you. And it's at these times that God will reach out through another member of this program and pull me back into the sunlight of the Spirit. And that's what happened to me through a man named Bill Honeycutt. So I came to terms with my God again. But I still had so much trouble with that sentence in the Big Book. I could hear somebody at the tape table talk about something wonderful, say that sentence, and I would feel absolute rage. And I sponsor a lot of women in this program. And because I have the story I have, I sponsor women that have suffered terrible tragedies. And one of these women, whose tragedy is much too gruesome for me to even tell you from the podium, made the mistake of telling me that her tragedy must be God's will, because in the Big Book it says absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. this woman desperately needed comfort, and I went off on her like a crazy person, and I started screaming at her to the top of my lungs that that wasn't written by the first 100 alcoholics. It's not in the first 164 pages of the big book. I took the big book, I slammed it down, I said, that's not even in the first two editions of this book. And I made this woman cry. And at that point, I knew I had a problem. I have a resentment about something in the big book. And this resentment is not only hurting me, this resentment now is hurting other people. And because it was hurting other people, I came to a place of really being willing to give it up. And I prayed for a very long time for God to just help me with that sentence. And about 7 or 8 years ago, I was with my sponsor, Polly. And she was in a little meeting in Long Beach sharing her story, and she was talking about a tape out by Clancy. And if she was here speaking for you, she'd tell you to go to the tape table and order that tape. And it's called Alcoholism, Disease of Perception, and it talks about our distorted thinking. And right in that meeting, when she said the words, disease of perception, I had the biggest spiritual encounter that I have ever had, and I couldn't hear another word Polly said, and I couldn't see anything in the room. It was like a big white light. I had an inner voice talk to me, and it was loud, and it was clear, and it wasn't through the ears. And it said, Michael, you know what happens in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is part of God's world. What happens when you're working those 12 steps is part of God's world. The progression of all good is part of God's world. What happened in that car 9 years ago was part of man's world. So I came to a place of being able to separate man's world from God's world. I was able to come to terms with that sentence in the big book. And tonight I can tell you absolutely nothing in God's world happens by mistake. It's God's world that got me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So 2 weeks after I had that spiritual experience through a real weird series of God coincidences, I found myself sitting down at a dinner table having dinner with Dr. Paul, who wrote that sentence in the big book. And I was at such peace, I did not have to go off on this man and tell him all about my resentment. Because I knew at that point it did not matter what he meant when he wrote it. What mattered was how I perceived it. And sometimes I have to work on my perception so whatever that perception is, it can work in my life. And that might not work for you, and that's okay, because I truly believe that God works for each one of us at our own level of understanding. I once heard, if you take one step towards God, God takes 10 steps towards you. And in this lifetime, as we know it, we will never, ever reach God's level of understanding. But once we're on a spiritual path, God does not want to lose one of us. So he comes to each one of us, and he works for each one of us at our individual level of understanding. And that's why what works for you might not work for me. What works for me might not work for you. But the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is whatever you believe, it will work within the 12 steps. Since that day, that man's heard my talk. We've had lots of spiritual talks. We've talked at lots of conventions together. He even became my spiritual advisor. And I still talk about him in the present tense. And we lost Dr. Paul. It'll be 2 years ago, May 19th, this coming May 19th. But when I talk, I still feel his presence. And what he told me about that sentence is he did not mean anything like that when he wrote that sentence. He told me he was not thinking of man's inhumanity to man. He said my spiritual experience was the best explanation he could think of as to why evil exists in this world. And I'm so thankful I paid attention to something I read in the 12 and 12 under step 10. It said restraint of pen and tongue. Because when I found out this man was still alive, I used to think everybody in the big book was dead. When I found out this man was still alive, I cannot tell you how many countless times I sat down and I started to write him a hate letter and tell him exactly what I thought about him and exactly what I thought about that sentence. And if I would have followed through, I would have missed out on this gift, because this man became a gift in my life. And he used to get lots of letters about that sentence. He used to get lots of phone calls about that sentence. And what he did a lot of the time is he just gave him my phone number. Anyway, I want to thank you for having me here. It's been a wonderful weekend, and I just can't tell you how much I've enjoyed the other speakers and all the friends I have here that I've met from the past. And I know today I've been catapulted into what Bill calls that fourth dimension of existence. And I like to talk about it because Bill talks about it in two places. The most quoted page is page 25, where he says, rocketed into that fourth dimension. But my favorite page is page 8, where he says, catapulted into that fourth dimension. Because on that page, he gives you a description of what that fourth dimension is like. And I can tell you today, in that fourth dimension, I know happiness, I know peace, but best of all, absolutely best of all today, I know usefulness. Thank you.